thank you once again to Deputy Pádraig McLoughlin, Sinn Féin Chief Whip, Senator Niall Blaney, Fianna Fáil spokesperson on Northern Ireland, and Councillor Ali Fallon, Farron, 100% redress councillor in the Inishowen Municipal District. 1 hour for each of the topics because they were really quite interesting. And we've received, with no exaggeration, hundreds of messages from you across our WhatsApp, text, phone calls, and on our social media. The level of interaction on this programme is astonishing. So thank you very much to each and every one of you. And I'm going to get through as many as I can. I get through them all, generally speaking, over the course of time. Hopefully this UK Supreme Court ruling on the definition of a woman signals the beginning of the end of the trans toxicity and the influence of the trans mafia, who for the past decade have tried to persecute people and even cause them to lose their jobs with their nasty cancel culture attacks on anyone who dare oppose the trans view. Just ask J.K. Rowling. Well, if I did ask J.K. Rowling, she wouldn't frame it like that, I don't believe. I understand where you're coming from, and I understand that J.K. Rowling, who funded that legal case to some extent, is very sympathetic to the rights of women and girls in terms of you know, private spaces and what have you, but she also is of the view that trans people do exist and that their rights need to be respected as well, providing they don't infringe or encroach on women's rights. To be honest with you, that's how I would read her. There's lots of coming in on different things, so I'll be going back and forwards. Mr. Blaney, your government and Fine Gael have let this happen in Letterkenny. Your own councillor involved in housing, refugees. Now you're coming out saying it's the right time you spoke to your party. Hi, Greg. The recent influx of large groups of men from a completely different culture into our cities, rural towns and villages is causing massive problems for the women and girls. The information is definitely not being over amplified. It's not being reported on the media. I shall say, we literally talked about it this week. It's not being talked in the media at all. If it wasn't for the online shared content, we'd never know again. It's not affecting the politician or those that make the large money, so they'll keep it coming. I understand that you can't listen to every show, but we spoke to the father of the person who was attacked in Letterkenny during the week, also featured on Community Garda information as an appeal as well. But look, you know, like I flagged this before 10, is enough being done in terms of integration? Firstly, I think if you, I think everyone recognises that if you move a large group of individuals from a different place into another place, there's going to be teething problems, to put it extremely mildly. But I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of behaviour that might make people feel uncomfortable, gathering in big groups in certain areas, it's going to be bad for business. They may not be doing anything wrong, just sitting, just gathering, right? But I mean, you know, as we heard from one of the contributors before 10, you know, maybe people should be advised that this is intimidating, or in fact, maybe is there any education that's required in how you engage with others? I don't know. I don't know. But we're talking about it on this program, even though people never talk about it. It's interesting. We discussed that, and I saw from pages on Blockfrom for some reason or other, people analysing my reaction to that story as if I was about to cut someone off when we were speaking to the dad of the person that was assaulted, or that I panicked because something was said. I had a great deal of knowledge of that case. He was invited on to give him a voice. You know, nothing surprised me about that. I wasn't shocked. My face didn't drop. I'm not paid not to put that stuff out. It amazes me. These people would be far better off not blocking me and engaging with me and having the conversation. But anyway, it's fine. A caller says it's not Ukrainians that are the problem. Regarding antisocial behaviour and immigration, there is a man currently in a tent who's a foreign national. These people have nowhere to go. Some of them have nowhere to go. A caller says Sinn Féin backs an open door policy. They're all for immigration. I can only but go by my conversations with Pádraig McLoughlin, who's the chief whip of that party. And that's not the impression I got, but that's up to you to interpret. Hi, Greg. The amount of people I've been talking to since Christmas has defective concrete, and the amount of their own money they're out themselves is unreal. 40, 50, 60,000 before they can start to rebuild again. This should not be happening, says a listener. It's not that houses with mica cannot be sold. The banks won't provide mortgages to purchase properties containing mica. A cash buyer can purchase a property with mica and then let it out with no restrictions. Of course, some things go without saying. When we're talking about the movement of the housing stock in Donegal and people with houses with a level of mica, the amount of cash buyers knocking about is very, very slim. So the fact that these houses may not be able to be insured, or you can't get a mortgage on them, that's what the problem is. It's not, we've already discussed that it seems to be, the science says, you can have a level of mica with no issues whatsoever. The problem is that unless there's unless it's defined, right, people can't buy houses with trust, and banks won't lend on them, and you won't get house insurance. So that little bit I thought we knew, but I appreciate you pointing it out. Sinn Féin's On Your Side policy calls for children under 16 to have the right to take parents to court to force a sex change where parents object. Okay, I'm not sure if there are policies in relation to that. Greg, asking the parties who advocated the words woman and mother from the Constitution is a bit rich. Too completely. I think you can recognise what a woman is, but also I know exactly what you're saying, but the removal of words of the word of the woman in the referendum, I think those two things are the same, but some see them as separate, and some people they used the change to the Constitution as a part of the debate about access to women's spaces and what is a woman, etc. 50% of who, Greg? Women are 50% of the population, sorry, is what I was saying. I just noted that the reaction from, when I was watching Sky News and BBC News, I don't normally, but the story was so big I thought I might, and I just noted that the reaction to the court case yesterday was mostly from the trans community, which is fine, I'm not saying that's wrong, but I mean, it wasn't proportionate. I don't want to come across as I'm anti-anything, I'm not, by the way. Typical Sinn Féin stance there. No such thing as being born into the wrong body. That's utter rubbish. It's a mental health issue. Full stop. A piece of paper and a pink tutu doesn't make you a woman. This nonsense has done the people who have a real struggle a huge disservice. Given the ruling by the Supreme Court in Scotland, well, it's in the UK, but it was actually the Scottish government that were in court, the UK Supreme Court. As Sinn Féin chief whip, does Pádraig McLoughlin have an issue with Councillor Sandra Duffy sharing a post criticising the ruling on the legal definition of a woman and criticising the banning of puberty blockers? Now, Deputy McLoughlin, in his comments, did say, in my view or in my opinion, which I think he did purposely so as not to necessarily say he was stating policy of the party or other members of it. He was speaking in a personal capacity. A lot of people will tell you that there's nothing wrong with the scheme. This is the defective concrete block scheme. It's the greedy builders, contractors that are destroying the scheme. Time to name and shame. In terms of gouging on the scheme, I'm not saying that's not happening. But in this county, we've got an awful lot of people building, rebuilding through the scheme. And we've got an awful lot of people seeking builders for renovating derelict or vacant properties as well. There's a lot of demand for tradespeople, highly skilled tradespeople, and there's not an awful lot of work, and I think that's driving up the prices as well. A caller says, the way Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil have treated the mica pyrite issue is a disgrace. They had no consideration for the well-being of people affected and the adverse impact on their lives. It's not that they haven't managed to fix the problem. They've made a conscious decision not to fix it, believes this listener. Shame on them, and people from Donegal should remember that. They haven't done what they took for our votes. When is the government going to do something about the price gouging of builders in this country at the moment, says another listener, a few people mentioning that. Nothing matters outside of Dublin unless there is an election, then the leaders arrive in abundance to do the dutiful nodding. A photo op and off they go again. Back to the court ruling. Yesterday was a victory for common sense, and Ireland should take note. All women need to be respected, not downgraded by a delusional ideology which is destroying sport and in some cases putting women at risk in their private space. And on it goes. Thank you so much. Our gardener Paul McLaughlin's back in studio with us taking your gardening questions, which reminds me, I do need to get lawn seed. Greg, you have to get lawn seed. I'll try and remember that. But Paul's going to be up with us just after 11, taking your gardening questions. We had the dry spell. Now we've had a bit of rain. The landscape of our fields, our lawns, our window boxes, if you live in an apartment or a flat, are changing. Any questions for Paul? 086 60 25,000. Right. Now, the number of children receiving support for sexually harmful behaviour increased by 43% last year. A report from the Journal Investigates found 83 children were referred to Tusla's National Interagency Prevention Programme in 2024. Investigative journalist at the Journal Investigates, Patricia Devlin, joins me on the show now. Patricia, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Right, an interesting piece of work. How do we define sexually harmful behaviour?
So sexually harmful behaviour would be defined in, you know, TUSLA and health terms as age inappropriate behaviour, which would be sexual. So in terms of TUSLA, they provide a intervention service for children aged 3 to 17 who present sexually harmful or abusive behaviour. And what's in place there is a support system where children receive therapy and support.
Now, there's been a big increase, 43%, from a relatively, what many people might perceive as a low base, but we are talking 3 to 17-year-olds here. And of course, this intervention is not catching or everyone either. What do we believe has led to this increase?
Well, as part of our investigation into these numbers, because really what the catalyst for us was comments by two district court judges back in October, within days of each other, in two separate sexual assault cases which involved young people. And one of the judges, Mr. Justice Paul Burns, had said there seems to be an increasing number of sexual offence cases involving young men before the courts, where access to online pornography has been deemed a factor in offending. So we wanted to look at that. And so we approached TUSLA and we asked them for some figures. And then we also approached the Gardaí Youth Diversion Programme. And what we found there was that there was an increasing number of young people either being referred for prosecution for sexual crimes or being referred to this intervention service. So we knew there was an issue and we knew that we needed to kind of get to the root of it. So when I spoke to experts, they believe that online porn access is certainly a factor in this offending. It's increased over the last 10 years. It's also changed. So no longer do consumers seek out pornography like they may have done 10, 15 years ago. Today, algorithms are pushing pornography, particularly to young people. And experts say the reason for that is because that they hope in time that young people will become regular consumers of their product.
And it has to be connected to the dramatic increase we've seen on, you know, young people being abused or assaulted by their peers. Because we got statistics here last year. I can't draw on them immediately off the top of my head, but there was a worrying increase in, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old girls, mostly, and boys, but they were the victims of sexual assaults by their peers.
Absolutely, and that's what the experts say. I'm talking about child safety experts, online safety experts, educators are seeing peer-on-peer abuse skyrocket in schools. Like one teacher, Owen Delaney, who is also a gender studies coordinator, said that he has seen sexual harassment go through the roof in schools, and he puts that down to the sharing of pornography between young people and the impact it's having on how they perceive their relationships with other peers. And what they're wrongly being made to feel is healthy relationships, because 99.9% of pornography, I'm told, has some sort of violence in it.
Mm. And I'm conscious that it's Easter holidays and we have a wider audience than we might otherwise, but just so parents are aware, when you were talking about when you were talking about pornography being directly targeting younger people, we're talking about very popular shows like Paw Patrol, Baby Yoda, where through presumably artificial intelligence, because what it can achieve now in terms of video creation is unbelievable, that those characters are being displayed in a pornographic and engaging in pornographic activity.
Yes. I mean, I actually had to go and view some of this material, and it is striking how, until you see that it's pornography, you would not be able to tell the difference. And that, you know, as a mum myself, starting off in this investigation, I was absolutely shocked to see what children could be exposed to on the internet. And I didn't have a clue, and I thought I was savvy, but it's coming from them at all angles. And that's why experts and activists want to see proper legislation put in place to restrict children's access to this. Because sadly, you know, parents do everything they can to protect their children, but when they're online, they have very little control at present.
I know, I understand an awful lot of the focus is on lads when we talk about things like this, but also there's a huge impact on girls and women from pornography. And I think a lot of it is about sort of unrealistic expectations, or how they're supposed to behave or act in intimate situations. So they're also being exposed to this, and they're also being educated in a different way as well. And as I say, that's something that does concern me in all of this. You know, in terms of how what we know, the problem we have is we can't do nothing, right? Okay, be it at home or at school, because there are people actively targeting our children. Right, so the position of doing nothing means that they're further exposed. So we can't ignore this is happening, because it's not a there's not a status quo here. What's happening is there are external factors trying to influence, and individuals trying to influence our children. So I suppose as parents, to be conscious of this and our children's online activity, Patricia, maybe in schools, you know, how teachers can broach an issue like this. Maybe there is a role there. They can't raise our kids for us, right? But they spend an awful lot of time with in that learning environment. So what as your research found, we could or should be doing?
Yes, well, as I mentioned, Owen Delaney, who has, you know, spearheaded this in Ireland, you know, calling for action, has said, like, it's a no-brainer for him that new teachers would be trained in delivering something called porn literacy to children in schools. Now, that doesn't involve showing children pornography at all. It involves teaching children that what they see, that porn exists, it's there, but what they see is not real life, it's not healthy, and to be very critical of it, and, you know, that what you see on the screen is not how you're supposed to act. You know, it's not healthy. It's not a healthy relationship. So he would like to see that as well as legislation, because the issue is, I'm sure a lot of teachers would feel uncomfortable about broaching this subject. And he believes that perhaps if that was brought in training, then in the right way, that it could help children in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Also, to the interesting statistics looking at it, you know, referrals to the Donegal Youth Diversion Programme. And for one reason or another, a lot of those accused of alleged sex crimes were found not to be suitable for that and sent back for the courts to deal with. I wonder what that tells us.
Well, it is very interesting. They're concerning figures. So for anybody listening, you know, under the Children's Act, if a young person between the age of 12 or 18 commits a criminal offence, they must first be referred to a youth diversion project. So the Gardaí lead Ireland's main youth diversion project, and that project aims to keep them out of the criminal justice system, to get support, to get guidance, and to stop them from reoffending. So we asked for figures concerning those who had committed sexual crimes referred to the youth diversion project, and last year there were 362. But not every person or young person gets accepted onto this programme. Some are rejected for various reasons. That includes perhaps the crime is too severe, such as murder. In terms of sexual offences, we don't know what is considered severe because of data protection from the Youth Diversion Project. But of those 362 cases, 335 of them were rejected last year and sent back to Gardaí for prosecution. So we don't know why that is. The Gardaí won't tell us because of data protection, but the Irish Penal Reform Trust has asked serious questions around this and says we need to know, because we need to know why children aren't suitable for a youth diversion project.
Okay. Thanks very much indeed for your time. I do appreciate it. You can read Patricia Devlin's full investigation on the Journal. It's part of the Journal Investigates section. Thank you very much indeed, Patricia Devlin. I don't know about Apple devices, but a lot of our younger people have Fire tablets. And if you go into settings and you type in the search bar parental controls, you can put your password on it and restrict your children from the internet, from accessing the App Store or Amazon Prime or whatever else you have on that tablet. You can pick and choose what they access. So you can have, they can have the tablet, and you can you can withhold everything except the games that they might play. And that's exactly what young people are going to do. Android also have a parental feature there as well. The tools are there. I believe these companies need to be doing more, but the tools are there. And I suppose if we start introducing those tools when the younger ones are 4 or 5 or 6 now, there's no point saying they shouldn't be on tablets or whatever. We live in 2025. That seems to be their life now. Not their life now, but part of their life now. But there are tools on the Fire tablet. They're hard to find, but also on Android, where you can block off certain elements of what they're doing, and you can deactivate Wi-Fi at certain times and what have you. And it's worth sitting down and having a look at that, because it's real. We're not making stuff up here, or we're not sort of saying this could happen. It's happening. These are the figures that are there, that young people are being targeted with imagery like Paw Patrol that will catch their eye, and as it turns out, then it turns out to be of adult in nature. Let me put it to you like that. So, big thank you to Vinnie and Eileen Harper in Remelton, who sent me through a lovely Easter card wishing you lots of happiness at Easter time. Thanks so much, guys. I really do appreciate it. Right. Dr. Joe Kelly is our historian. Good morning to you, Dr. Joe. How are you getting on? Good to have you on the show, as always.
Good morning to yourself, Greg, and to all listening in Highland Radio. How are you?
I'm good. Are you enjoying your Easter break?
Absolutely, and the weather is making it even nicer. We're blessed with good weather for the last few weeks, we could say.
We certainly are, aren't we? Today we're going to explore the life of an English aristocrat and heiress who became an Irish rebel. Her name would be familiar to us here in the Northwest. She infamously hijacked a helicopter in Gortahawk in 1974 as part of a bombing attack on the RUC station in Stranraer. So let's talk about the life and time of Rose Dugdale. What are her origins?
Well, it's a very interesting life, and she died last year, and maybe it was a little bit controversial and too early maybe to speak about her, and maybe still is, but she was born into a very wealthy family in England. Her father worked with Lloyds Bank, and he would have been a million, not Lloyds Bank, but Lloyds Insurers, that underwrote insurance. He was a multimillionaire. He had a 600-acre estate in Devon. He was part of the British aristocratic culture, and she was born into that, an older sister and a younger brother, and she was educated. Like, she had a French governess as a young girl, and she was sent to a private academy in London, in Kingston in London, Miss Ironside. And she was a very popular young girl. I mean, it was talked about her. Everybody adored her. She was generous, clever, dashing, millionaire's daughter, who was full of life and laughter. So she was obviously a very jolly and intelligent, bright woman. And she went then for a young girl, she went then to, with wealth, she went to Europe to kind of as a finishing school. She went to France and Germany, where she was multilingual. She was very interested in music, very talented musically, spent time in Greece and Italy as well. And then that would have been probably secondary level education. She was finished to a very high standard of education. And then comes along, she's about 17 at this stage, 1958. And what the process was for young girls like that at that time would be that they would, there were debutante balls. It was a big part of the circuit in London at that time that you were presented to the Queen, any young girl that would be suitable for marriage and looking for a husband. So there was kind of a series of balls, and they would actually move from event to event every night. and it would be highly sophisticated and dressed, and it would have been a terrible cost to it. So this wouldn't have been open to any young girl. You would have to be of a certain...
Before we move on about that, so would you nominate yourself to be a debutante, and would it be with a view to finding a partner? And was that the say, for instance, in this case, Rose herself or her family, or would she be invited to, or what was going on there?
Yeah, well, anybody from the aristocracy was in the know, if you can imagine, and this had been going on for maybe 200 years. And actually, Rose, 1958 was the last year. It was stopped after that because Princess Margaret said we had to put a stop to it because every tart in London was getting into it, and it became, you know, less than what they had hoped it would be. So they put an end to it. But you were presented to the Queen. And in that year, 1958, Rose was among the 400 presented to the Queen. These were young girls that were suitable for marriage. And it was basically an old system. And after 1958, it ended. And Rose, it guiled her. She didn't like it because it was so lavish. And what she said herself was the money that would be spent on dresses, a pensioner wouldn't get it in 6 months. And she just didn't like this.
But she was off money, so was she uncomfortable with being a nepa baby, I suppose they might call her now, that, you know, she's from this great wealth but could point out the unfairness of this this process?
Yeah, look, she had everything going for her as regards to a comfortable life, but it seems at that point in her growth and in maturity, her conscience was such that this just rubbed against her. She didn't like the wealth and the privilege that she was being given, and she saw the world and through other people's eyes at a very young age. So she didn't want to go to this ball, and she negotiated with her parents, okay, I'll go because you want me to go, but there's one condition, I'm going to get a third level education. Now, you go back to the late 50s, that wasn't a very common thing, and particularly for a young girl of her wealth, marry her off.
So money wasn't an issue. This was, no, you need to find yourself a good husband and start producing grandchildren ASAP, because that's what we expect of you.
And she said, look, I want an education. So they agreed that if she would go, so she went then to Oxford to study politics, philosophy and economics. And it was at that point then her ideologies, particularly her left-leaning ideologies, began to emerge. And again, try to understand that women at that time, young girls and colleagues, they were very much at the end of the privilege role in male hierarchy. And so she actually went into the Oxford Union, which was controlled by men, dressed as a man, wearing men's clothes and a wig on her, to make a protest. So she was very much active and challenging not just the role of society with regards wealth and her aristocracy, but also the role of females in society and giving them equality. And again,
right, so I asked a bit earlier about her background then. So at this point, you know, there's two conflicting issues here, you know, in terms of the patriarchy and money and all that kind of stuff, but also her background and what have you. At this point then, is she struggling with from where she come and who she thinks she is and where she wants to go?
Yeah, well, like there's a famous saying in Irish, Tagan and Duhus Fij, so the nature, what's given to you from your parents will always come out through you, but it seemed to have done the opposite in her. And her education in Oxford even changed her more, and then she decided to do a doctorate, and again the doctorate enabled her to get into a qualification and understanding and get a privileged position in life, because she could now work and earn money again at a time when women maybe wouldn't have had a PhD. She had, and she worked for the Ministry for Aid and Overseas Development for the British government. And when she was working with them, she realised that the British government were propping up dictatorships and oppressing poorer people. So it kind of all fed in from her youth. Now she's a qualified, educated, competent young woman, and she's beginning to reject it. And she heads off to Cuba, believe it or not. And she basically sees a revolution in action in the 60s. And at that point, she's convinced on the whole social ideology and the redistribution of wealth.
And is that her switch complete at this point then?
Well, it's an ongoing process, because we're going to see that she gets radicalised to some degree and when she realises what's happening in Ireland. So sometime around when she comes back from her Cuban visit, she goes she's encouraged to go to the six counties, and she goes to Belfast and she meets people like Martin McGuinness. She sees what happens on Bloody Sunday. That horrifies her. She sees what the parachute regiment had done. She's really aware of what's going on in Northern Ireland, and she sees her country as the oppressor.
Meets a person called Wally Heat, and I do have to take a quick break. When I talk about that relationship and what happens thereafter, stay with us. We're discussing Rose Dugdale with our historian, Dr. Joe Kelly. More after these. We're in conversation with historian Dr. Joe Kelly. We're talking about Rose Dugdale. We've talked about her youth, her debutante to Queen Elizabeth, her education, insisting that she gets a third level education, her role within a government, and her trip to Cuba. And now she's back. She's meeting the likes of Martin McGuinness. She's seeing firsthand what's happening in Northern Ireland. And is it around about this time that she begins a relationship with Wally Heaton?
Yes, and he was a former British soldier. And again, he left the army because what he saw is colonialism and usurpation of power when he was in the army. And he said, look, this isn't for me. So she had met with him. And, you know, the thing that people judge Rose, but she was very genuine in what she did. And she had inherited a wealth of about 80,000. And she decided to sell her house and move to Tottenham and hand out that money to poorer people. She became known as the Angel of Tottenham. And she gave out money, quite all the money that she had, to poorer people when she saw the way that they were living. And Wally and herself, at that stage then, became more interested in the six counties. And she began, she had a Lotus, a sports car, and she used to ferry weapons across the Irish Sea for the IRA. So at this stage now, she was becoming politically radicalised in that sense. And was very much a champion of the issues of the six counties.
Do you think she would have been sought out?
Do
you think she would have been sought out for these types of roles, Joe, or reached out to try and do, in inverted commas, her bit?
I would say it was the latter, that she tried to do her bit. I mean, would you be, if you'd have been an IRA trust, a woman that was coming from an aristocratic background,
married to a former British soldier.
Yeah. So, and again, I think she was very committed and sincere in what she believed. Mm. You know, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist, but I mean, she genuinely believed that this was a cause that was worth fighting for. And again, Bloody Sunday had really affected her. And so in 1973, during the Epsom Derby, Rose and Wally burgled her own parents' house and robbed to the tune of £82,000 at the time. And that money was to the property, and the items that they had stolen was to be sold. And the money then would go to the IRA to fund the IRA cause. That was the plan. But they were caught, and Wally was given 6 years sentence, and Rose was given 2 years suspended sentence, and the judge had said it's highly unlikely that she'll ever do anything again. It was a lack of just judgment by her,
but unlikely to reoffend. So, what happened to Rose after Wally's incarceration? And is it around this time she finds herself in the Northwest?
Yes. Well, just before that, in the court, she says, she spoke of her father. She says, I love you, but I hate everything you stand for. And again, she'd shown that she was very, very transient in her thinking. She'd been won over to the cause, and at this stage she's moving back to she decides to move to Ireland, and she's, the relationship with Wally seems to stop very suddenly. She goes to visit him a few times after he's been jailed 3 or 4 times, and then she moves to Ireland, and she arrives here in Ireland around the beginning of 74. And it's at that time that, about Christmas time, 73, beginning of 74, it's that time then she meets Eddie Gallagher here in Donegal, who was about 6 years younger than her. And he was a very impressionable young man, and she seemed to have got on very well with him. And again, he was very much for the Republican cause, as would have most people in Donegal at the time, and considering that Bloody Sunday had happened. And such like. So what maybe got Rose thinking then, how could she get more involved? In 1973, there was a famous landing off a helicopter in Mountjoy Jail. The prison officers didn't know what was happening, and a few of the IRA inmates jumped on the helicopter. It was planned. They hijacked the helicopter and away they went. So this must have got into Rose's head. Remember, she's a very intelligent woman, and she was aware that the Irish helicopter had the contract to go round all all the lighthouses of Ireland. And they did this every month. See, Torrey Lighthouse, for example, it wasn't automated to March 1990. So helicopters had to go there and help service, bring out whatever supplies and to maintain the helicopters, and they'll also visit the islands and bring posts and things like that. So she was aware that there was a helicopter going to Torrey. So somewhere in her thinking, she says, well, here's my opportunity to hijack it. And so she approached, she came to Godhawk in 1974 in January and wanting to get a lift out to Torrey, and asked the pilot at the time, Captain Hobday, who was actually a former British Army helicopter pilot. And he said, look, I can't take you on this occasion, but book ahead and come back next month and we'll take you. And I've seen some of the records. She gave the address of Stephanie Grant was her name. 11 Great High View Leads. I thought it was amazing. Great High View Leads. This was what was written in the record of the Godhawk visitor's book. But So she came back on the 23rd of January, and they were flying to Torrey. She told Captain Hobday that she was going to be accompanied by her sons. Patrick Traherty was one of them, and Eamon McNulty. They were 20 and 18. And then also Eddie Gallagher was with her as well. So there were three men and herself. And they stayed in the hotel. And that morning then, as the helicopter was to go to Torrey, they flew out. And just as they were heading to Torrey, over in East Boffin Island, he felt a gun on his side. And she had a sign say, go to Ards Friary. And they flew to Ards Friary and landed there with the gun still pointed at him. They took on some churns. There was 5 10-gallon milk churns, and they had them filled with about 100 pounds of bombs. But they only could fit in 4 because the helicopter was too heavy for the helicopter, and they had to use string to tie the 2 doors to keep them in. But even at that, the helicopter was struggling. So they had to fly over the Mulroy and drop out 2 of the churns. And they exploded. They exploded in the water. So she proceeded. The aim was to go to Strabane to bomb the RUC station there, which they did. They proceeded with, and only had 2 churns. One landed into the river, the Mourne River there. Didn't explode. Another landed in a garden adjacent to the RUC station, but it didn't explode. So there was nobody killed, and they flew back over to the Castlefin, to the other side of the border, and made their escape.
But how did they think they could get away with that, though? And 11 o'clock is coming right at us, Joe. I don't know what we're going to do, because we're only getting to the... But, I mean, obviously, a really audacious plot. The 2 that they offloaded exploded, the 2 that they didn't. Were they apprehended for this?
Yeah, not initially. So there's a lot more to the story, because she continues. They weren't apprehended initially, and they escape. But for Rose and Shan O'Driscoll, who wrote a biography about her, heiress rebel vigilante and bomber, in his book he talks about this was one of the happiest days in Rose's life, that hijacked in off the helicopter in Godhawk, and that she felt that she was at the heart of doing something for the cause. And that inspired her to do more. So then some months later, on the 23rd of April 1974, she decided to rob a famous art collection that was held in Rossborough House in County Wicklow. A former Conservative MP, Albert Beattie, and he was an African mining heir, very wealthy man, had an unbelievable collection of paintings, Rubens and Goya and Vermeer, the Dutch Golden Age painters, say the 1650s onwards. And she knew the value of paintings. Don't forget, again, she was educated, and she had the idea of understanding culture and the arts. And she put on a French accent, letting on to be French, and she had accompanies with her. They rang the doorbell, and they went in, and they basically tied them up, and they stole paintings. Estimated at the time, this is back in 1974, to be worth about 18 million. If you were to put that in today's context, you're talking 100 and...
Right, Joe, you're going to have to get a cup of coffee and we'll finish the story after 11. I'll come back to you at 2 minutes past 11. Stay there. We're talking about Rose Dugdale. I can't skip over the last part of this story. Joe's grabbing coffee. You grab coffee too. We'll take a break, come back with the news, and then we'll wrap it up. Before we go into the garden with Paul...